Arizona utility regulators are hearing from APS today about charging higher fees to its solar customers. Earlier arguments from both sides centered on the future of the industry.
The $5 fee didn't seem to kill it. It still seemed to thrive in APS territory. And then we've seen, well, fees of $50 actually do seem to spell death for the industry.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, why yesterday's decision on college football players unionizing may not be the last word. Tempe officials ask what residents want to see in their neighborhoods, and a gym where the members are furry and four-legged.
It's kind of hot to be taking the dogs out on walks here, so we do like an early morning walk and then we come here and play.
Plus, satirizing Arizona's news every day for a month, and man, has it been hot out there. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. It'll be sunny and hot for the rest of the day today, looking for a high of 107. That'd be a few degrees warmer than average. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the mid-80s. Sunny skies for tomorrow and Thursday with highs of 106 each day. Right now, sunny skies 102 degrees at KJZZ. After examining water quality samples locally and from upriver states following the Gold King mine spill, officials do not expect mine contaminants to greatly impact Arizona water. From the KJZZ Science Desk, Andrew Bernier reports.
After coordinating with Utah officials, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, or ADEQ, analyzed samples taken nearly 100 miles upriver of Lake Powell in the San Juan River. The data suggests water quality conditions are generally consistent with pre-spill conditions. Additionally, ADEQ has measured its own samples of water in comparison to historical levels and standards. It does not expect the spill to have short or long-term negative impacts to either Lake Powell or downstream in the Colorado River. As remnants of the spill disperse into the lake, it is worth remembering the full contaminant volume would only equate to 71 millionths of a percent of the water currently in Lake Powell. In Phoenix, I'm Andrew Bernier.
Health officials say a man from Maricopa has become the first confirmed case of West Nile virus this year in Pinal County. The Pinal County Public Health Services District says it's treating the man. His name and condition haven't been released. West Nile virus is transmitted to humans through mosquito bites. Pinal County is urging residents to take steps to help reduce the risk of West Nile and keep mosquitoes at bay, namely getting rid of standing water, using insect repellent, and fixing broken window screens. The Arizona Corporation Commission today is hearing arguments from Arizona Public Service to raise the fee for the utility's new solar customers. APS says it needs the extra money to account for a shift in the cost of maintaining the grid, which the utility says is now being borne more by non-solar customers. Ryan Randazzo is a business reporter for the Arizona Republic and is covering the hearing, which could run into tomorrow. And Ryan, what exactly is the commission considering?
APS charges solar customers an average of about $5 a month today for their use of the power grid. APS wants to increase that to about $21. The regulators can decide whether or not they want to haggle over this issue today or whether they want to put it off until next year when APS is going to raise rates on everybody, or at least request to do that.
And that initial $5 fee is not that old, right?
No, it was approved in 2013 and went into effect last year. APS's contention is that even with that $5 fee, the rate of solar installations has not slowed down. They argue it has not hurt the industry and that the industry could withstand higher fees.
So has anything substantially changed on the commission other than a few of the members that would lead one to think that the commission might reverse itself from less than 2 years ago?
Well, there are two new commissioners. So the three who were on the commission in 2013 all were very much leaning towards $20 a month fees for solar. The two that have been replaced, the ones that left office, wanted even higher fees. They wanted something closer to $50 a month. So this is sort of the first test for the two new commissioners who are elected last year.
What are critics of this proposal saying about it?
Well, they argue with the entire premise that solar customers are getting a free ride on the power grid. That's sort of the position that utilities across the country are taking, that these customers still take power at night. They still draw power when they're running several appliances at once during the day. And because they rely on the full infrastructure of the power grid, they should be paying more than what they currently do. The solar supporters and rooftop companies argue with that entire premise. They say they're contributing power to the grid, that they should be given more credit for the benefits, especially the environmental benefits, of using solar versus fossil fuels.
When this issue first came up a couple of years ago, one of the other arguments that some of the solar company folks made was that this will be the end of residential solar in Arizona if this higher fee goes into effect. Is that a line of argument that is continuing now?
That is a line of argument they use, because APS wanted fees that were going to be $50 to $100 a month. And through a compromise at the 11th hour, they settled on that $5 fee. The solar industry actually came up with that $5 fee, and they said that that's something that would be hurtful, but that they could live through. Since then, we've seen SRP enact fees that are about $50 a month, and almost nobody installs solar in Salt River Project territory anymore with those fees. So there was some discussion, is that just rhetoric? Would fees really kill the solar industry? The $5 fee didn't seem to kill it. It still seemed to thrive in APS territory. And then we've seen, well, fees of $50 actually do seem to spell death for the industry.
Even though SRP is not regulated by the Corporation Commission, could that case be something that the commissioners consider when they're thinking about what to do with APS?
I think absolutely, because those utilities are neighbors, they share service in the Metro Phoenix area, sort of a patchwork. They work together on all sorts of other issues that the regulators are definitely going to look at what's going on next door.
Ryan Randazzo is a business reporter with the Arizona Republic covering the Arizona Corporation Commission meeting on APS's request for higher solar fees. Ryan, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The National Labor Relations Board yesterday declined to take up the issue of whether football players at Northwestern University can unionize. That's after a regional NLRB director had ruled the opposite last year. But the issue is likely not settled. For more on that, we turn to Stanley Lubin, a Phoenix labor attorney with the firm Lubin and Enoch. And Stanley, were you surprised by yesterday's decision not to take the case?
I was surprised on the grounds for the decision. The decision itself of declining to allow them to organize under the statute could have been made on other grounds. I was very surprised that they declined jurisdiction.
Why is that?
Well, because they have exercised jurisdiction over professional sports, and these players are pretty much professionals, let's face it. And the board doesn't decline jurisdiction like this very often. They could have done something a little bit broader. And that's why I think that there's a possibility that they might, in the future, change their mind on this thing. If the student athletes got together at all of the privately owned universities, they may have reached a different decision.
So do you get the sense then that if those schools got together, more specifically the players at those schools got together, the NLRB might decide to take this issue up?
They left it open. I don't know what they would say.
Do you read anything into the reason that the NLRB decided not to take this up, at this point at least, and did sort of, as you say, leave it open?
You know, I've been seeing stuff on the Internet that are all over the place in terms of why they did this. We have to remember, this is a board that is now fully appointed by President Obama, and this is considered to be a pro-labor board. I don't think it is. I think it's fairly neutral. And yet, they were unanimous. So will they look at this and reverse it? I don't know.
Does there have to be some kind of waiting period before student-athletes or anyone else would bring this issue again? I mean, can they bring it tomorrow with a larger group of people, perhaps?
Yes. The waiting period is 1 minute. They have to get signatures or support from a certain percentage of the people in the unit that they want to be covered in. So the Northwestern football players, for example, maybe at halftime they could meet with the other team and see if they're interested, if they're playing Stanford, for example, or one of the other private schools like Notre Dame.
Do you have a gut feeling as to what will ultimately happen here?
You know, I have a gut feeling that the union is going to appeal it. But beyond that, I don't think that the courts will overturn this, in all honesty. I think it's a close question, but I don't think they'll overturn it.
Close question for now.
For now. You never know what's going to happen down the road, you know. There are much smaller entities that the labor board takes jurisdiction over. I mean, their normal standard is $50,000 worth of interstate business. Football does that in 30 minutes, if that long. You know, if it takes them that long. when you consider the ticket sales and television and all of that, I mean, they're in the gazillion dollar range. So there's really nothing small about this.
Stanley Lubin is a labor attorney with the Phoenix firm Lubin and Enoch. Yes, we know it's summertime, but even by Arizona standards, this month has been exceedingly hot. The four-day stretch between last Thursday and Sunday set an August record and had many of us Googling vacations to Alaska. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman found out, combined with higher-than-normal humidity, the hot stretch made for a double whammy of warmth.
Yes, we know. It's Arizona in August. What would you expect? But over those 4 days last week, the temperature averaged 103.7 degrees, breaking the record for the month for that time period. And so far this year, Arizona has had 19 days with temperatures of 110 degrees or above, already surpassing the yearly average of 18. Excessive, unusual, or just Arizona in the dog days of monsoon season? I asked state climatologist Dr. Nancy Sellover.
Absolutely it is. It's not necessarily usually this hot this late in August, however.
I think what most people are looking at are the highs, but what we're noticing and a lot of people are noticing, especially those that get up in the middle of the night to go to work or are up really late, is that the temperature really isn't getting any lower than 90 degrees. And it's the lows that seem more alarming than the highs in many ways. Do you notice that as well?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Until about the mid-90s or so, we didn't typically have many, if any, nights where the low temperature was 90 or warmer. Since then, it's sort of been increasing a little bit. It really jumped up. In 2003, we had 12 days where that was the case. Usually there was like none or one. And then we started having more of those in about 2005, 2006.
Is there a pattern that you see developing, whether it be global warming or not, that we are so warm in parts of the days when we should be a little bit lower?
Well, right now, at this point, a part of the year, we kind of look more toward the monsoon and the circulation patterns we have and the moisture that we have than a global signal. If we look toward warmer winters, we're looking maybe at a more global signal. But it's kind of this combination of humidity and temperature that brings those nighttime temperatures up. Typically, when we're looking at 117, 115, and that kind of a temperature, we're looking at days where the dew point is down below 55. It's either the low 50s or sometimes the upper 40s. So when that happens, we have that drier air. When the sun goes down, it tends to get cooler at night, and we tend to drop below 90. But right now, we've been having this past heat wave we have, which is part of why that daytime was so uncomfortable, is we've had these dew point temperatures in the mid to upper 50s, combined with these really high temperatures that makes it really unbearable. But then that moisture at night is what's been helping to keep those nighttime temperatures high.
We all feel it when it gets up this high, and as you mentioned, with the humidity on top of it. What about, besides humans, other living things? Are we seeing any animals, plants, that are particularly affected by this extreme heat?
I'm not so sure how much of the plants are affected, but the animals certainly can be affected. I know things like the dairy cows have issues if they don't get rest and cool temperatures overnight. It reduces their milk production, and I'm sure a lot of the wildlife have similar situations. The desert wildlife tends to be relatively adapted, but they're all out there looking for water. I know in my yards I'm seeing toads and things coming looking for water that I hadn't seen in the past. Because it has been a while since we've had really significant heavy rainfall. So it's definitely tough on the wildlife.
That's Arizona State climatologist Dr. Nancy Sellover, who says we have about 6 more weeks of monsoon season before drier and hopefully cooler conditions begin creeping back into our forecast.
Still to come, a Valley cartoonist has been satirizing Arizona news every day this month, including an environmental situation.
The potential toxic waters from the Gold King mine leak or spill made its way just to the border of Arizona, and my characters fought a Gold King risen from that toxic waste. Very comic booky.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Quickly checking traffic. I-17 southbound. The exit ramp at Union Hills is restricted. Elsewhere on the 202 westbound Santan Freeway, accidents at McQueen and Gilbert Road. It'll be sunny and hot for the rest of the day. Phil's story was definitely telling the truth, wasn't making it up. It is sunny and hot. Look for a high today of 107. 108 was our high yesterday. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s. Sunny tomorrow as well with a high of 106. Right now, it's mostly sunny, 103 degrees at KJZZ at 220.
KJZZ is supported by Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust, serving Maricopa County nonprofit leaders through transformational Piper Fellowships. Applications available at pipertrust.org/piperfellows.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. For many parents at home, when playtime is over in a household of boys and girls, Barbie gets tossed into the jumbled toy box with G.I. Joe. The fast cars and the cute ponies are all thrown in together. The stuffed animals sleep happily with the fierce plastic dinosaurs. Even though such toys were bought in different aisles of the department store, boy stuff and girl stuff, their fate is to end up in the same box, just like in Toy Story. So whose idea was it to segregate the toys in the toy store, even though they all get mixed up when they become toy stories? Well, Target Stores, in response to online consumer shaming, says there should be no toy segregation anymore.
This is Wendy calling from Flushing. I think it is time that we revamp our approach to childhood toys. Because considering my 3.5-year-old daughter, she's all about dinosaurs, which I know are gender neutral, but any dinosaur t-shirt I've ever found is in the boy section. And also, I have a 14-month-old son who loves nothing more than to pour me pretend tea in his older sister's purple tea set.
This is Catherine from Dallas. What difference does it make whether a doll is pink or blue or a truck is blue or pink? Kids play with toys, period.
Lise Elliott is a neuroscientist and author of Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. She says the discovery of gender by little kids is a small, unpredictable mystery with big consequences.
Far and away, the bigger influence over toy preference is social learning. And the reason we know that is when kids are young and before they go to preschool, and particularly if they don't have parents that are training them what to play with, they will play with everything. Kids are very exploratory. They get bored with one toy and they'll move on to the next, assuming nobody's looking over their shoulder, staring at them for playing with the wrong color toy. And once kids go to preschool and they're in large groups of peers who've been more indoctrinated into the pink or blue, that's when they start to shun the so-called gender inappropriate toy.
So Target may be onto something here in terms of, you know, separating toys, you know, may actually reduce sales, that if you mix them up, there's less of that feeling of having someone look over your shoulder. If you're a boy staring at the girls' aisle and a girl staring at the boys' aisle, there's less anxiety. You can just choose exactly what you want to play with rather than worry about the category.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a smart move because we know there's a lot of books out now about boys who are not fitting into the absolute masculine model, and, you know, with the whole transgender movement, who love pink and sparkly. There's a book called My Princess Boy. There's other clothing lines now that allow boys to wear pink and allow girls to wear shirts with dinosaurs on them and space images. Most people think that the gender segregation of toys actually was fueled by manufacturers so that they could essentially sell twice as many toys. Because if something like a bicycle or a lunchbox or a toy phone comes in two different colors, you know, an older sister's not going to be able to hand that down to a younger brother. And so companies thought they could sell twice as much.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, is it possible that having this non-segregated world of gender items, of toys, et cetera, will allow children to explore their ambiguities about gender without having a lot of anxiety, and that parents can see things differently than just they're being, you know, they're being put into a category that they don't like, that there's somehow a different way of coming forward with one's own particular, you know, gender ambiguity, be it transgender, be it sexual preference, that sort of thing.
You know, I don't actually think that breaking down the boy and girl aisles at Target or anywhere else is going to suddenly increase the number of, you know, transgender children.
No.
The truth is that what you play with doesn't shape your sexuality. It doesn't shape your gender identity. But what it does do is help your brain practice certain skills. So if you're playing with blocks and building toys, Legos, you're going to develop a certain set of spatial skills that's very helpful when you get around to math class and geometry and physics. And if you're going to play with baby dolls, you're going to develop a certain set of nurturing skills that's going to be very handy when you get around to being a parent. So I just view toys as a big, huge playground that allows children to exercise every part of their brain. And if you draw a sharp line and only let certain children play with certain toys and vice versa, you're going to limit their skills down the line.
Finally, I'm amazed. I have three girls and two boys at, you know, how the conditioning can actually get through, even if as parents you think you're trying to prevent these categories from being apparent to kids. They get signals very, very subtly and conclude things that you never thought you taught them.
Yes, right. So gender, as we understand it, is actually a spectrum. And we all have certain features that are masculine and feminine to different degrees. But children don't get that. They're little minds think much more clearly in opposites. So gender is actually one of the first opposites they learn. Even before they're 1 year of age, children understand the difference between male and female faces and voices. And so once they get to this age close to three, where they're starting to figure out their own gender, it's a very black and white or pink and blue kind of issue. You're either one thing or the other thing. If you wear pink, that makes you a girl, no matter what you're wearing under your underwear. And so it can be very frustrating for parents to try to teach children the nuance when everything in the culture is screaming, you know, boy or girl.
Lise Elliott is Associate Professor of Neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School and author of Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. Thanks, Lise.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. August is often considered a slow month for news in Arizona, but a Valley-based cartoonist has accepted the challenge of finding a daily story. Every day this month, he's creating a comic strip on Instagram featuring one of his superheroes satirizing Arizona news.
The demand is to post something every day and tell a consistent story. So it's almost a month in the life of these fictional superheroes that live here in the Valley.
Are these characters dealing with Arizona headlines? Are they dealing with national or international headlines?
Generally Arizona headlines, but it seems that a lot of our issues impact national headlines as well. The horses at Saguaro Lake had some national attention. Monsoon season always seems to get some national attention. I grazed over the GOP debate. So yeah, generally speaking, my topics are geographical and based right here in the Valley. But again, it's difficult to not address some of the issues that Arizona is well known for throughout the country.
What gave you the idea to do sort of a concentrated, let's do something every day in a month idea?
Well, I'm a fan of political cartoons as much as comic books. So I wanted to pay homage to both of these illustrative media that I like in a way that is modern and somewhat progressive in use of social media. So Instagram provided the perfect platform for that. It is essentially already a single panel, like a political cartoon, but we use our lives to create that combination of image and text to create a singular impression.
What kinds of adventures or maybe misadventures did your characters get into, like, for example, with the monsoon weather?
Well,
Do they drive into a flooded wash or something like that?
No, I often try to caricaturize the mundane with superhero adventure. So I have a supervillain named Mike Roburst. He's a living microburst. That is his superpower. So he is responsible for the flipping of those 40-some airplanes at the Chandler Airport a couple weeks ago.
Well, now we know what's behind that.
Absolutely. See, there's a secret superhero culture happening in and behind our Arizona headlines. It's kind of the premise of Amazing Arizona Comics. The potential toxic waters from the Gold King mine leak or spill made its way just to the border of Arizona, and my characters fought a Gold King risen from that toxic waste. Very comic booky, and as far as you would understand that story, quite possible. So those are the ways I've been able to use like the environment to tell a superhero adventure. And again, these are the headlines we hear every day, but it just addresses them in a different way to make it a little more entertaining and to keep my interest as somebody that's a fan of news, but always paying attention to the 24-hour news cycle, the redundancy of it. So this is a way to keep it fresh and interesting.
Doing a panel every day for a month, has that given you any extra insight into this place? I mean, does it teach you something, or maybe do you see things differently than you did when you were doing it maybe just more occasionally?
Absolutely. I am finding some continuity and consistency in stories that are seemingly unrelated. Truths of life that might seem too dire and dark for comic books, you can't help but address them when you've committed to a daily strip like this, ripped from the headlines.
Political leaders in the state often joke about trying to stay off the Daily Show and trying to sort of improve the state's image. And I'm curious if that's something that you think about as you're satirizing stuff going on in this state.
Absolutely. And I think that their presence in this satire and in comedy that addresses the daily news, it's unavoidable.
Russ Kazmierczak Jr. with Amazing Arizona Comics. Russ, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Despite the summer heat, school has started or is about to start across the state. Pencil sharpeners will be whirring, dodgeballs ricocheting off concrete blocks, and a little tiny arsenal of zingers will be ready to be unleashed on the playground. Parents, though, are ready to support their kids, although SAS Karina Bland wonders at what point should they step in.
Every year before school starts, my email inbox gets flooded with press releases filled with advice about how to talk to kids about bullying, how to recognize bullying, and how to bully-proof your child. It sounds easy when you read about it. But I remember when a girl in my son's third grade class called him stupid on a daily basis. Every day, he came home. She called me stupid again. Every day. Was this bullying? Should I intervene? Because after a week of it, I worried my 8-year-old might actually believe her. Tell her to shut up, I told Sawyer one night as I tucked him into bed. Really? Sawyer asked. No, of course not. But there was no reason that he should sit quietly while someone called him names. But Sawyer didn't want to tell the teacher, and he didn't want me to either. I got that. When I was a kid, if someone called you a name, you just called them a name right back. Today, we teach our kids to tell anyone who torments them, I don't like it when you say that, or that hurts my feelings. We tell them to tell an adult. But I couldn't help but think about a more direct approach. If someone calls a boy fat, maybe he should just retort with, you have Dumbo ears, or so what, I heard you still wet the bed. I'm not advocating any playground violence, but I do think kids should stand up for themselves. Kids are supposed to report the little harassers, but they most often don't, and the bullies get away with it. Sawyer had already told the girl to stop calling him stupid. She hadn't stopped. I probably should have told him to ignore her or ask the teacher to change his seat. Instead, I told Sawyer that the next time the girl called him stupid, he could say something like, at least I can get smarter. You can't get less ugly. Not one of my greatest parenting moments. Sawyer walked into school the next day armed with a ready comeback and permission to use it. The funny thing was, that day, the girl didn't call him stupid. Not the next day either, or the next. After a few days, I wondered out loud at dinner if it was his new air of confidence that was keeping her in her place, or maybe the gleam in his eye. Sawyer told me the actual reason. Because I stopped acting like a cat. Apparently, the girl was just calling it like she saw it.
Karina Bland writes the column My So-Called Midlife for the Arizona Republic. Coming up, Venetians' dollars go a little farther than those in other cities, but how does that affect minimum wage workers?
Well, I think that it's great that the dollar is stretching farther in Phoenix and in Arizona than in some other places. I'm still concerned about the ability of folks in Arizona to really meet their basic needs with their wages right now.
That's ahead. It's the show. On Valley Freeways, I-17 southbound, an accident at Peoria. On the 202 westbound, Santan Freeway accidents at McQueen and Gilbert Road. It'll be sunny and hot for the next couple of days. Look for a high today of 107. Right now, it's 103 at 234.
KJZZ is supported by Valley Metro, working to benefit the community, including those who rarely use public transit, by creating sustainable jobs through further development of the transportation system. ValleyMetro.org/connected.
When the United States invaded Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks, Osama bin Laden went on the run, abandoning his Kandahar base. Among the finds of what he left behind was a library of more than 1,500 audio cassettes. The BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera has been granted rare access to this unique collection.
In 1996, in the wilds of Tora Bora in the Hindu Kush, Osama bin Laden recites a supplication before declaring war on America. This now infamous threat against the United States was relayed to the world on a simple audio cassette, the perfect tool for proselytizing and propaganda. And this particular recording was bin Laden's own, one of a collection found in Afghanistan following the fall of the Taliban.
These tapes were found in the months following 9/11 in Kandahar, Afghanistan, in bin Laden's former house. He'd been in Kandahar from 1997 through 2001.
Flag Miller is professor of religious studies at the University of California, Davis, and the only person to have listened to the entire archive.
What's the earliest tape you found which features Osama bin Laden?
Earliest tape is from 1987, from a battle. It's a live audio recording of commanders in Afghanistan speaking in Arabic, include bin Laden. And they're taking on Spetsnaz Soviet commandos, and they're planning a bombing of a warehouse.
How do you know it's Osama bin Laden in that tape?
I've listened to many of bin Laden's tapes. It very much sounds like him. And then at one point, people refer to him as Abu Qaqa, which is a well-known nickname for him.
I mean, it's quite interesting that he or someone around him is making a tape of being on the battlefield.
Yes, absolutely. He was very sophisticated at self-marketing. I mean, the audio tapes that we find in this collection are very much part of the story, the kind of myth-making that went into giving bin Laden a new face.
I mean, some people, when they heard you were going through bin Laden's cassette library, might have thought, is this the kind of stuff he listened to personally? Was it his Phil Collins collection or something like that? Did people ask you that?
Yeah, no, definitely. There were a lot of curiosity as kind of what was the range of bin Laden's musical tastes. It's hard to know exactly which of these tapes he was a fan of. One of the tapes in the collection is Gaston Granaciel, an Algerian Jew who was just a terrific singer and migrated to France and became a world celebrity. Most of this tape is a lecture on Palestine. And suddenly, in the midst of this political speech, the tape cuts out. And Gaston Granaciel's voice comes in, and he's singing about les gens du Nord, working class northerners in France.
One of the last recordings in the collection is from the wedding of Osama bin Laden's bodyguard, Umar. What's the significance of that?
Yeah, this is a recording made in March of 2001, and it's the one tape in the collection that mentions Al-Qaeda in the sense that we know it today as an international militant organization led by bin Laden. Al-Qaeda's publicity committee sponsoring this tape.
How does Osama bin Laden himself feature on that tape? Because he is now a wanted man, isn't he? I mean, is he audible on it?
There's a lot of mirth on the tape. Then bin Laden comes up, and it's no longer mirth. He talks about the ways in which celebration is important, but he also says not to let mirth overshadow the fact that there are more serious and austere issues at play here. He then talks explicitly about a plan that he's aware of, and he doesn't reveal the details, but what he does say is, we are about to hear news and ask God to grant our brothers success.
With that final recording, the 9/11 attacks were just months away, and with them the capture of this unique audio archive. An archive which charts Osama bin Laden's evolution from a wealthy playboy fighting the Soviets to a man about to wreak havoc on America.
That's the BBC's Gordon Carrera. Tempe officials have been asking residents what makes their neighborhood special and unique. It's part of the city's character area plans, which dovetail with its voter-approved general plan 2040. Residents who live around Apache Boulevard tonight will have a chance to see what their neighbors have been saying. Hunter Hansen is a long-range planner with Tempe.
The general plan is required by law, but that only goes so far. So what we wanted to do, what we heard from people throughout our public process, was that places and spaces are very important to them. So we wanted to have kind of the take it one step further from the macro scale and really focus on the neighborhood scale, which is character area planning, and that we can really hone in and focus on the local areas and things that matter to people in those communities.
What people tell you about what they would like in their communities, there's no money associated with it. The plans are not binding. What kind of impact do these tend to have, or do you expect that they will have on the particular communities?
We have kind of a hierarchy of laws and codes and regulations that we deal with the city. For example, starting at the top, we have a general plan and zoning and development code. That only goes so far. And what we really wanted to get at with this character area planning process is that layer that goes beyond that. How do we start to create place? How do we brand identity? How do you talk about the qualitative aspects of space, shade, connectivity that goes beyond just what's, you know, called out or required by law? So this is a way to get at that layer that's beyond just the technical layer.
But how do you actually make it happen? I mean, people might say we want X or we want this or we don't want this in our communities. From your perspective, how does it actually get implemented? How do you make it happen?
I'm looking at that hybrid of kind of the common sense and the wisdom pulled together to inform planning recommendations. For example, we had a 14-year-old in Tempe that said, Arizona is called the Valley of the Sun for a reason. It gets hot. Shade would be great. But not boring shade, he says. It should be colorful, happy, and bring a smile to people's faces. So how do planning comments translate to, say, public policy or planning recommendations? You know, when we talk about landscape requirements or suggestions for multimodal connectivity, we can start to infuse the planning recommendations that we hear from, you know, our oldest and wisest and our youngest to inform what comes next.
So it's more a matter of you're soliciting feedback, which won't necessarily be implemented as part of this initiative, but will sort of find its way into potentially other codes or ordinances or other types of rules that the city puts into place.
Yes.
Do you find that residents in other parts of the city are concerned with sort of the attention that the area around ASU and downtown Tempe get? I mean, do people in other areas of the city feel left out or that maybe they don't get the kind of attention that they need?
Yes, we've heard that. And one of the reasons why we started our character planning process in South Tempe is that we heard from residents. They felt that Tempe had been very focused on building Town Lake, getting light rail implemented. We had spent a lot of time and infrastructure and improvements and energy and money on our downtown and lake environment. So giving some love, if you will, to South Tempe was a priority of the council, and they decided to start in South Tempe.
So is this going to be sort of an ongoing thing that as you continue to get input from residents, that as you get it, you'll sort of digest it, try to get it into ordinances, into codes, into rules, things like that, as opposed to having like, here's a big rollout, everything that we heard, we're going to do it right now?
Our process is iterative. You know, it is back and forth. It's a dialogue. And I think that when you talk about placemaking, it's less about projects and more about place. And place is constantly evolving and changing.
Hunter, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Hunter Hansen is a long-range planner with the City of Tempe. Arizona is often considered a place with a low cost of living, but the Pew Research Center decided to look at where a dollar stretches the most and least. The group looked at the much-discussed $15 an hour minimum wage, and then mapped where workers would get the most bang for their buck. The numbers are from 2013, but they show in much of Arizona that $15 would be worth more than that. For more on this, we turn to Kelly McGowan, Deputy Director of the Arizona Community Action Association. And Kelly, what do these numbers tell you?
I'm a little concerned about the 2013 figures because recently some numbers have come out this summer that the cost of goods and services have continued to rise. And since June 2014, we've seen a 2% increase. So while I think that it's great that the dollar is stretching farther in Phoenix and in Arizona than in some other places, I'm still concerned about the ability of folks in Arizona to really meet their basic needs with their wages right now.
So you think these numbers might be slightly outdated? The dollar might not stretch quite as far as these numbers suggest?
I think that it could possibly be skewed. We also saw some data come out from the National Low Income Housing Coalition more recently than these figures that showed that somebody needed to earn over double the minimum wage to be able to afford housing costs in the metro area here. So I think they could be a little outdated.
How do workers look at numbers like this when they see that, oh, if I'm getting $15 an hour, maybe it's actually worth in Arizona slightly more than that?
Sure. I think that workers are going to look at their base pay and what they're taking home and their ability to afford their basic expenses across the board. And if their ability to do that, if their wage helps them meet all those expenses, it's going to be viewed favorably. And if it doesn't, it's not going to be viewed favorably. So even if they're earning $15 an hour and it stretches potentially to $16, $17 based on these figures, but they still are struggling to put food on the table and pay their utilities, it's not going to be viewed favorably.
Is it a tough sell when you see numbers like this for employers to pay that kind of a salary when they know that, hey, if I pay $15, it's actually $16 or $17, so maybe I could actually pay $13 and have it be $15 in reality?
Well, I would hope not. I think that there's a movement across the country for businesses. There's a lot of talk about income inequality, and we recently saw that the SEC came out and is going to require public companies to report the difference between CEO salaries and the median salary of workers. So I think that there's a movement by businesses to understand what their employees are going through and their ability to participate in the marketplace and be healthy members of the community. So I would hope that they wouldn't want to lower it based on these figures, that they would want to treat their employee holistically and view their ability to make it in the place that they're living.
Could something like this be seen as a recruiting tool for the state that, you know, people could say, hey, come to Arizona, you can pay $15 an hour and it'll go that much farther for your workers, whereas if you go to a place like New York City or Chicago or Washington, D.C., that same $15, you're not going to attract the same quality of worker because it's not going to mean as much.
Sure. I think the cost of living is a consideration for any employer in coming to a place. I think that there are a lot of other factors that are put into consideration. The education system, arts and cultures, things of that nature. So the cost of living and the wage that is capable or that the company is capable of paying is one consideration.
Did anything about these few numbers surprise you?
They did a little because in the work that I do, I don't know that the reality of what we're seeing on the ground matches up with this data. We know that one in four jobs in Arizona is considered low wage and that we've got close to 40% of working families considered low income. And so the fact that you can stretch your dollar a little bit further doesn't mean that there aren't still people struggling with poverty in our communities. And so I think it seemed to me like there was a little bit of a disconnect.
Kelly McGowan is Deputy Director of the Arizona Community Action Association. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound, an accident at 16th Street. Also I-10 eastbound at Van Buren. On the 202 westbound, Santan Freeway, accidents at McQueen and Val Vista. It'll be sunny and hot today with a forecast high of 107. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 19%, sunny skies, 103 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by CFA Institute. The Chartered Financial Analyst designation is awarded to investment professionals who mastered a globally relevant curriculum of investment knowledge. You can find local charter holders at cfainstitute.org.
Street artists tend to do their work in the street, where people can see it. But for Australian-born and Brooklyn-based street artist Jamie Toll, the street for one of his exhibits was the middle of the Arizona desert near the border, specifically picked for its remoteness. Toll put up three 20-foot sculptures of a metal bear trap, a frying egg, and a melting globe, took a bunch of photos of them, and turned the whole thing into a virtual reality experience.
I had to make a decision, you know, like, of what I wanted to do in my art, and I could have put a sculpture in the middle of Times Square and, you know, would have got some sort of publicity and maybe how many people would have seen it. But, you know, I sat down and thought about, by putting sculptures into the most arid and most out there environment, ironically, by using technology, which I did with the virtual reality, I could actually take the sculptures further and have them being broadcast further to a greater audience than just, say, even New York City, you know?
Right, so you put three sculptures in the middle of the desert near the Arizona-Mexico border, and then, as I understand it, you just took a gazillion photos of them to turn it into a virtual reality?
What we did is, so we built three sculptures. It was all based around immigration reform. I'm an immigrant myself, and I decided that I wanted to have a conversation. And obviously, Arizona being sort of a hotbed was somewhere where I decided that I wanted to actually go and start the conversation. So we went to the Arizona, to very remote parts of the desert, and we built the sculptures in Phoenix itself. And this was in June, July. And then we took those sculptures, once they were built, we took them out to the desert and we reassembled them in the desert and left them in the desert completely. And what we did was we virtual reality it. So we got there's a special camera, and that came from London, and it captures millions and millions of photographs, and the computer restitches them together, and so it actually immerses you in a photograph. So in other words, you can walk around in virtual reality in that photograph and see the sculptures.
You mentioned that you wanted to have a conversation about immigration, and I'm curious why you picked Arizona. I mean, there are any number of places, either in the U.S. or around the world, that are also sort of dealing with similar types of immigration issues. Why Arizona?
For myself, the reason I got into immigration was my partner is from South America, and we went to go to Australia 1 year, and we were basically locked out. They just denied us entry. They said that she was a flight risk, and, you know, she had been married to me in Australia. We had an Australian child. So I, as a 6'1" white guy, I was a little bit taken back that I couldn't even get back into my own country, into Australia. So I started sort of looking into immigration, and it obviously affected my life. So it affected me as an individual. And then, I can't go back to Australia. It's a very long way to do the sculptures in Australia. I'm based in America. So I sort of looked in, and from my perspective, Arizona is an amazing place. Most Americans I talk to tell me that they want to go to Arizona. You know, there's got so many national treasures. So, you know, for me, it was just made sense, you know, to go to one of the most remote places. And obviously, there's ongoing issues which has to be sorted out down in Arizona. And I just felt it was a great opportunity to go down there and sort of start a conversation.
Have the pieces generated the kind of conversation you were hoping they would?
It was a lot was about timing. You know, like Donald Trump came along, and that was not expected that Donald Trump would come out and say sort of outrageous, from my point of view, outrageous statements. So he sort of, I wouldn't say he stole my thunder, but he certainly started the conversation before even I got an opportunity to get into it.
How did you pick the exact spots where you would put these? And was it public land? Did you get permission from somebody who owned the land to put your sculptures on it?
No, as a street artist, you know, I don't, as a rule, ask permission. I just went and put it on. I made sure I didn't put it on any native or any national parks. You know, I went out a month earlier and spent a week out there and went and recce'd the whole area. So I went and scouted for all these spots. look, I could just build sculptures and have them dotted outside Phoenix and just tell people, well, I went to Arizona. It was very important to me to find locations where they were very arid and very out of the way and basically remote, that people would not find them. I felt that the art project deserved to be authentic, and I felt that that's what made it authentic. So, you know, we spent a good time, you know, 12 hours in a car traveling each day looking for sites.
Jamie Toll is a street artist based in Brooklyn. Virtual Borders Arizona is now available as a mobile app. Going to the gym can be a slog, even for the fittest among us. But for our canine companions, when Arizona's summer heat is most punishing, an inside workout space can be a great alternative. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry tells us about a Tucson gym that's made specifically for dogs.
The gym's name is a loyal companion. Inside, a small, three-legged white poodle named Lucky is trying to stand on a balance pad.
You gotta get all three of your feet on there. Only see one foot on there.
Lucky's owner, Sharon McGrath, is coaxing him onto the pad with a treat. And then...
There it is. Oh, what a good boy. Good boy, Lucky, you did it.
It's little victories like this that Kate Titus gets excited about. She's the owner and founder of this canine gym and recreation center. I know, the concept can be a tough one to wrap your head around. It's an awful lot like a human gym. There's a room with exercise equipment, personal training, a pool. And even massage. Titus is the masseuse.
I like to work in a circular motion. I can feel the muscles underneath the pads of my thumbs and in the tips of my fingers and the pads of my fingers. And I'm really, really just working those back and forth.
It sounds a little overindulgent. But for Titus and the folks that bring their dogs here, it's not about pampering their pets. It's about keeping them healthy. And like people, some dogs need a little more help with that than others. For example, Lucky has some mobility challenges since he only has three legs. His owner, Sharon McGrath, says staying fit is really important for his quality of life.
And the vet said as long as he keeps his muscles strong, then he should be okay.
Back at the pool, Mia and Chloe are eagerly playing fetch in the water. Their owner, Tracy McGarry, is standing at the front of the pool smiling and taking turns throwing toys to each dog. She says the gym is better for her dogs than exercise in the Arizona heat.
It's kind of hot to be taking the dogs out on walks here, so we do like an early morning walk and then we come here and play. So it's been fantastic.
Kate Titus opened the gym in January and says she has about 50 to 65 memberships at one time. But beyond the balance equipment and squeaky toys, the gym offers something even more unusual. Castings and fittings for dogs that need aids, like braces or wheelchairs. Here's Titus.
What we do is post-rehabilitation. So once they graduate from rehab and now they're in maintenance, they come and see us and we either design programs for you or they come in and just have fun in here.
Titus says she was inspired to create the gym because of her dog, Harley. He has a number of health problems. He blew out both of his knees, and as a result, he has trouble walking. So for Titus, this gym is about making sure dogs stay strong and mobile as long as possible. And their clients? A lot easier to deal with than ordinary gym rats.
This is where we really differentiate ourselves from a human gym, where you go in, it's like, oh, I have to go to the gym today because I'm going to get fat if I don't. These guys come in here and it's like, wow, we want to have fun. We get the game. We want to do it.
Membership isn't cheap. It ranges anywhere from $29 to $149 a month. But Titus maintains that isn't so bad when you consider that it could prevent your dog from getting an injury that could lead to a costly surgery. And while it's clearly not for everyone, there are some owners who find massive benefits to it, even learning life lessons from their pups. Like Tiffany Bialis, the owner of a tiny dog named Bonnie who works out at a loyal companion.
You'd never know she was a three-legged dog unless you saw her from the right angle, right? She walks pretty well. She does everything that everybody else does. It's a wonder about dogs. Dogs don't know how to feel sorry for themselves, so they just go through life like they're perfect just the way they are. And I think that that's so incredibly special.
Now, if only humans believed they were perfect the way they are, we wouldn't need so many human gyms. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And be sure to be with us tomorrow morning at 11 for KJZZ's Here and Now. The host, Steve Goldstein, is here with me. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Mark.
So what do you have?
Well, Senator Jeff Flake's going to be joining us tomorrow. He's been in the news even more than usual lately with his decision to vote against the Iran nuclear deal. Also, Cuba. That was, of course, a big thing on his agenda for many years, and on normalized relations around the way.
You'll also have a new education leader from the state.
NAU President Rita Chang will be talking about the new school year opening up, and what about the budget challenges facing NAU and other universities in the state.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now tomorrow morning at 11, then be back with us 2 o'clock Thursday and Friday for the show. The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director, Al Macias, executive producer, John Hoban. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.